I believe that the number one problem among single adults is loneliness. The tragedy is that many people try to just cope with it rather than overcome it because they fail to understand what the problem really is. Loneliness is not having anyone with whom I have a relationship that gives me the freedom to share who I am and where I am at any given moment. It is that lack of relationship that causes loneliness because I need those people with whom I can be me. I can be real. I can share my joys. I can share my hurts. I can share my good sides. I can share my faults. There is a difference between loneliness and aloneness. Aloneness is not having anybody around, and all of us need some alone time. Introverts need more than extroverts because they draw strength from being alone, so they need that alone time so that they can be recharged. Even though extroverts also need that alone time where they can feel refreshed, so they can relate to God, so they can come to know themselves. Loneliness, though, is not being alone. It is that lack of relationship. Have any of you ever been lonely in a crowd? Did any of you, formerly married, recall the first time you walked into a singles group after becoming single again? You walked in, there may have been 300 people there, but you felt as if you were totally alone, totally by yourself, that no one there knew you, knew where you were coming from, nor understood you. It was that lack of relationship, of belonging, that lack of closeness, that lack of being able to share because you knew you belonged to them and they accepted you just the way you are. That's true, because the problem is we were created by God to be in relationship. Eric Byrne, I believe, is on target. When in the book, Games That People Play, he says that our need is for intimacy. He's using that term in the area of emotional intimacy. God created us to be in relationship with Him, with each other, and ourselves. Matter of fact, salvation is a relationship with God through Christ. It is not a plan, it is a man. It is a relationship that we establish. I'm very concerned about a number of Christian singles who I think are about to commit a very grievous error when they say, I've got Jesus, I need nothing else. Because you see, God created us to be in relationship one with another. And the Bible goes on to say that each part of the body supplies the needs of the other part. God is actually intended for us from the very beginning to be in relationship one with another. Yet that which I need, I fear. I'm afraid of relationship. First of all, I fear relationship because I fear rejection. I'm afraid that if you get to know me, you will not like me. On one occasion, I had done a seminar and a lady was sharing with me how that one of her friends was kind of perplexed when in the unit on sex, I acknowledged that I had a sex drive. And she said, well, he's a preacher and he's got a sex drive? And I got to thinking, man, if she has a tendency to reject me for something that's real, that's okay. What would she do if she knew my faults? I have a friend of mine that I tell him sometimes I think you are unfortunately lucky. I'm envious of you because he's been through a divorce and remarried, but God in His grace has allowed him to continue to minister. He's been on the staff of one of the largest Southern Baptist churches and now is in full-time evangelism. And very few people even know that he's been through a divorce, and he seldom has to tell it. But every weekend, in order that I can relate to people and people know that I can understand what they're experiencing, I have to relive the pains of my own experience, of my own divorce. And it hurts, but I wish I could avoid it. I wish I could escape it. But it's part of that fear. Because you see, I have the fear that when some of you find that out or some people learn that about me, they will reject me. I can't accept Clyde. I have that fear of rejection because I want to be loved. I want to be accepted even as you do. I'm also afraid that you might use it against me. That when you find my defects, my flaws, you will use them to control me or manipulate me in some way. three Baptist preachers, and understand it was Baptist preachers, had gone to a conference. They'd heard a sermon on the value of honest confession. And so, on the way back to their hotel, one turned to the other two and says, you know, we ought to practice what he spoke about tonight. Why don't we gather in my room and we'll just share with each other our biggest faults so we can pray for each other. So they got into the room, and the first one said, you know, I hate to admit it, but being a Baptist preacher, I'm not supposed to drink. But he says, I get off to a convention like this where nobody knows me, and I'll go out and get a drink. Second one said, you know, I hate to admit it, but mine's similar to that. I'll get off at a convention like this where nobody knows me, and I've got to take in a girly show, you know, a go-go show or something like that. Third one is quiet. Well, come on, tell us what your biggest fault is. And finally, after much persuasion, he says, well, I'll be honest with you. My biggest fault is gossip, and I can hardly wait to get out to talk about you guys. I'm afraid that if you find my faults, you will take them and you'll use it to manipulate, to control me, to get me to do what you want me to do so no one else will know it. I'm afraid of it being used against me. I'm afraid of competition. I think one of the worst phrases in the English language is the phrase, the best. Paul Tournier, an eminent Christian psychiatrist, says that to that degree that I'm in competition with another person, that person is my enemy. Now stop and think about it. One of the problems that a lot of us have is we're always competing with one another. We're trying to be the best. And because we're competing, we find that sometimes that can become very destructive to us. For instance, a lady shares with a lady friend a deep secret of her past. Well, she's comfortable. That's her friend. 6 months later, though, for some reason, she and the other woman both have their eyes set on the same gentleman. And all of a sudden, that dark secret becomes general knowledge, and she knows the source of that secret because, you see, all's fair in love and war, right? That's what Machiavelli teaches us, and that's love. So, bam, whatever I can do to shoot you down, whatever I can do to win, it matters not because I have got to be the best. And so I'm afraid of that competition, but also I'm afraid of the cost. There are two parts of this cost. First is the cost of time. Whenever I link my life with another person, I commit me and my time to that person. When I was pastoring a church in Port Arthur, Texas, our staff frequently ate together on Wednesdays. One Wednesday, as we were eating, the husband of one of our secretaries had joined us. He was one of the deacons in the church. And during lunch, another secretary says, Clyde, so-and-so is in the hospital over in Beaumont, about 20 miles away, and they want you to come visit them. Deacon said, yeah, just like that person. Hadn't been to church in 7 years, but let them get sick, and the first thing they want is the preacher to come visit them. Our minister of education, who had a rather dry sense of humor, said, Clyde, what we ought to do is prepare three cards. One card we give to the people of the community as a whole and say, this card entitles you to the services of our minister between the hours of 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. within a mile of the church. To those members who came spasmodically, we give a card that says, this card entitles you to the services of our minister between the hours of 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. within 5 miles of the church. And to those five-star members that did everything, including tithe, we give a card that says, this card entitles you to the services of our minister 24 hours a day, wherever you might be. Shortly after I had moved from Port Arthur to Pasadena, I got a call from one of the young deacons. He said, Clyde, our new pastor's come onto the field, and he is leading us to begin a care ministry so we can show the love of God by linking our lives with people and loving them to Jesus. I said, great. Have you counted the cost? He said, what do you mean? I said, you know, it's one thing to say to a person, I love you like God loves you, and I'll come visit you when it's convenient. It's another thing when they call 30 seconds before the kickoff of the Super Bowl game, and you are a football fanatic, and they say, I've got to talk to you right now. And it's another thing when you get that phone call at 2 a.m. in the morning, it's 33 degrees, misty raining, and the guy on the other end is a person who has a problem with alcohol that you've been working with and praying about, and he says, Clyde, can you come talk to me? And you climb out of that warm bed, drive over to the payphone from which the called you, and stand outside in that misty rain because he's too embarrassed to go into the all-night restaurant across the street, and shares with you how that during a commando raid as a ranger, he had killed his best friend, and he had been trying to anesthetize his conscience for 10 years through alcohol. And you let him share with you at that point. There is a time factor, because when you link your life with a person, you commit yourself to share your time with that person. There's also, though, a pain level. Shortly after I moved to Lafayette, Louisiana as pastor, two of the deacons were talking with me, and they said, "Clyde, you cannot allow people's problems to bother you and concern you like St. Clair Bower, your predecessor, and followed a man who was truly a saint of a man. At 58 years of age, because of the pressure of his involvement in people's lives, he had had to retire from the pulpit ministry. In 30 seconds, no, less than a split second, I turned to these men and said, 'Listen, when the day comes that I can no longer hurt with those who hurt, I am no longer fit to be called a minister of the gospel. You've got to link your life, and you've got to hurt with them even as they hurt, if you are to ever become one who is truly able to become involved in the lives of other people.'" By the way, St. Clair Bower became the area missionary. At 65, he had to retire from that position, went back and became the associate pastor of the First Baptist Church of Lafayette, and at age 75, retired from that position. What I'm saying is, when you and I link our lives with another person, we have got to experience pain with them if we are to ever be able to enjoy a relationship with them. I'm concerned about a lot of singles organizations, because what happens is, in the early days, they're hurting. Because they're hurting, they start a fellowship that reaches out to all the people who are hurting, and they start a good relationship, and they pick one another up. They lift one another up, but then what happens? They kind of work through some of their problems, and then they start wanting a super spiritual group so that they don't have to hurt with those who are hurting. They want those new ones who are still having their pity parties to have their group over there, because we got our super spiritual class over here. And I'm saying, any time we're not willing to hurt with those who are walking through the very pit of despair, we are not at a point whereby we can be truly friends. There is a cost factor that is extremely real whenever you and I link lives with another person. Loneliness is the lack of relationship. That relationship of depth that allows you to share who you are and where you are, and allows the other person to share with you in the same way. Therefore, I say to you that there's only one answer for loneliness, and that is building relationships. Getting busy will never do anything to overcome the problem of loneliness. As I've said on many occasions, I've never seen more lonely, exhausted people than single adults, because they're busy. I mean, they're going everywhere. They're going to this meeting, going to that meeting, and they come in at 2 o'clock in the morning, pop into bed, exhausted. Wake up the next morning, exhausted, but lonely. The only answer is to link your life with another person and build a meaningful relationship. One does not have to be married to be happy, but one must be involved in meaningful relationships to be happy. May I repeat that? One does not have to be married to be happy, but one must be involved in relationships that are more than just acquaintances. Depth relationships that give you the freedom to share who you are and where you are, and you give the other person the same right if you are to ever be happy and overcome loneliness. So I'm going to tell you, you don't have to cope with it, endure it. You can overcome loneliness when you build some meaningful relationships. How then do we go about building those relationships? Since the only answer is building those relationships, let me just share with you some thoughts and some ideas of what you can do to build those relationships so that you can have some good, solid friendships. First of all, you've got to accept the risk. Vulnerability. Vulnerability is to relationships what the wick is to the candle. Every time I reach out to begin a new relationship, every time I expend more energy to maintain a relationship, I take a risk. That person may reject me. They may get to know me and say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't handle you. I can't deal with you. That's their prerogative. That's their freedom. They can do that. I take the risk that they may become a friend, and then they may move out of town, they may die, or someone else may come along that takes more time from them. You know, some of you as singles know what I'm talking about. You develop a relationship with another member of the same sex, and then they get married, and they don't have any time for you anymore, and you just want to whop sometimes because, hey, look what I invested in. Can't you spend some time with me? There's a risk, but I believe that that risk is worth it because, to me, friendships are like drilling for oil. You may have 8 or 9 dry holes for every gusher, but when you get that gusher, it's worth it. It makes you a millionaire. Accept the risk. Secondly, you've got to accept imperfections. Anytime you expect another person to be perfect, you immediately set yourself up for disappointment because no one is perfect. You catch that? If my wife expects me to be perfect, she's in for a big disappointment because I've got many flaws, many defects, and so she's going to keep putting me up here. I think one of the most burdensome places in the world is to be a person with tremendous potentiality. Why? Because you feel like you've got to be perfect or they will not love you. And I say to people over and over again, just accept the fact that whenever you relate to another person, they are going to be imperfect just like you are. Accept imperfections. It's part of relationships. Then you've got to come to the place that you make friendship a priority. That you realize that it is one of the most important needs you have, and you commit yourself to creating those relationships. It's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all, or another cliche, that the pain of isolation is far more painful than the hurt of a broken or ended relationship. And I think the ultimate thing that makes me make friendships a priority is when I realize that people who need people are the luckiest people in the world. One of my counselees at one time was a psychiatrist. As we began to work through his problems, there were two basic areas. One was some resentment towards his mother that he had to work through. But the second problem was that he was trained in secular psychiatry. Being trained in secular psychiatry, he was brought up with that idea that you pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You only need yourself, you don't need anyone else. And because of his feelings of self-sufficiency, he felt that he was sick or weak because he acknowledged he needed people. That frightened him. How am I going to deal with this? How am I going to overcome it? I need people. When I was able to take the Bible and point how that God intended for us to need people and show that it was okay to need people, he became well. We have a reverse in our office from what you normally find. Most pastoral counselors refer people to the psychiatrist. He refers people to us because he knows how we were able to help him coming from that background and giving him permission to need people. And he feels so good he's become a better psychiatrist. His practice has improved. But he needed people. Hey, I admit it. I need people. I accept that as a reality. Then, if I'm going to build relationships, I've got to learn a very simple truth. What part of your anatomy do you use most in developing relationships? People that talk? Ears. That's right. Ears. One of the first secrets you learn in developing these relationships is to learn to listen. You see, I find that if people are critical of other people, they will be critical of me. Ladies, if you're dating someone who's putting all the blame for the breakup of the former relationship on the other person, run. Do not walk to the nearest exit because in 6 months they'll be doing the same thing to you. Men, likewise. You know, if they're blaming all of the problems on the other person, they're not dealing with their own deficiencies, their own needs, and facing themselves and trying to deal with something that is extremely real. So I say to people, listen. Now, as you listen, bear in mind that all of us have some hang-up areas. So learn to listen and find out if they're critical of everything or just critical of certain areas. For instance, when I was pastoring in Port Arthur, our church needed to begin two ministries. One ministry was to our racially mixed community because we were an inner city church, and secondly, we needed to minister to the formerly marrieds. Well, as I began the ministries, I had one deacon who hated blacks. As far as he was concerned, they were the scum of the earth, but he had compassion for divorced people. I had another deacon who had no racial prejudice whatsoever, but he hated divorced people. He thought they were literally scum. They should all just go out and commit suicide. That was his feelings. Now, when I wanted to talk about the church's ministry to our racially mixed community, I didn't go to the one who hated blacks. I went to the other deacon, and vice versa when I wanted to talk about our need to minister to those who had experienced the pain and agony of a divorce. I recognized where each deacon was and related to them at that point. And I think that's what you and I need to do. Listen, have you ever stopped to realize you've got two ears and one mouth? Use them proportionately. If you'll listen more, you'll find out where the other person is and then can share with them. Our tragedy is even when we say we're listening, we're talking and wondering why we're not hearing. And I say, listen. Listen to where they are and relate at that point. And one of my friends came to me one day and says, Klein, you've got a little problem. When you and I are talking one-on-one, you're very, very open. When you're teaching the Bible study on Sunday morning, you're open, but you're a little closed. Then when you stand up right after that and go into the pulpit and preach, you're much more closed. That's, I'm not playing a game. I'm just learning to recognize where people are and relate to them at that point. When you and I are talking one-on-one, we both know enough dirt about each other that it behooves both of us to keep quiet except to pray for each other. I said, when I'm teaching the Sunday school class, I talk to singles where they are. And I may use a word or two that they use in order that they may relate to me and understand I understand. For instance, I may occasionally use the word horny. But if I were to use that word in a sermon, by the time the deacons awaken from their faint, or maybe before they hit the ground, they would be asking me for my resignation. I just learned to relate to people where they are. And so I listen, hear them, find out where they are, and then try to relate at that point. And that's what you've got to do. If you're going to build some good, solid, meaningful relationships, you've got to learn to relate to people where they are rather than running off on a tangent somewhere. Then, you've got to learn to share slowly. I like to think of it this way. There are levels of emotional intimacy. I like the word 10, because 10 is a complete number. Now then, how do you measure them? I don't have a way to tell you how to measure when you slide from one level to another level. You know, I can tell you your car's a quart low on oil, but how do I tell you your attitude's a quart low? Basically, what I'm talking about is the deeper the risk of pain, rejection, the deeper the level of emotional intimacy. You get the picture? All right. One should never share more than one level beyond that the other person has gone with you. You get into a relationship. They quickly go to a level 3, but then they pull up and stop. You must not go beyond a level 4 with that person, because if you do, you will put too much pressure on the relationship and cause it to die. I know that deep within us there's a desire for that person to become a 9 or a 10, total openness. But we've got to acknowledge that if I pressure the person, I will destroy them. I had a dentist that was working some heroics, as he called on one of my teeth. He says, Clyde, I've got to move the tooth down, but I want to move it as quickly as possible, but I don't want to move it too fast, because if I move it too fast, I will kill it. That's what we can do with the relationships. Every once in a while, I'll have a lady come and says, Clyde, I'm ruined for life. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I was a church angel. You know, I taught Sunday school, I played the piano, I sang in the choir, and all those good things, and then I went through a divorce, and I went through the crazies. You know what I'm talking about. That period of time when you become the bed barfly and the bed hop, and you go through all this thing that so often happens, not everybody, but so often it happens. And he says, I went through the crazes, but after a while I got right with God, and I began to try and get my life back together. And God has forgiven me, but men will not. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I met this beautiful guy, and he was really a neat guy. He wasn't a loser. He was a winner all the way. And we went out on that first date so we wouldn't have to play games. I told him all the crazy things I'd done, so I'd get it behind me. And he never asked me for another date. He can't forgive me. I said, that's not the problem. The problem is he also did some crazy things, and he's not ready to share with you all the crazy things he did. So what he's done is he's run to keep from sharing with you. And so you'll meet that person, they'll come down to level three, and they'll stop. They'll throw in their air brakes, as I call it, because you've reached their comfort zone. To go beyond that, they're uncomfortable. They're not ready to share. They can't divulge where they are. So what do? You stop. And you let it stop right there for a while. You do what I call put it on the back burner. I love to do Cajun cooking. Now, in Cajun cooking, for a while, you work hard. You make the roux and you get everything started. And then you put it on the back burner and let it simmer. I've actually left it on the back burner and gone off to do a seminar. 2 hours later, come back and stir up 5 gallons of gumbo for the next day for a singles gathering at church. It's okay. So you got this person, they go down to level three, and then they throw in the air brakes, and you just put them back on the rear back burner and let it simmer a while. And you're building other relationships all along, so what do? You got this other person that's very methodically going, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you just keep letting it develop, and you relate to all these people. And after a while, maybe the person who's on the back burner grows up a little bit, or is ready to risk a little bit more, and they'll come back up to the front burner, and they'll go down to a level four. Maybe that's maybe hit a five, and then they stop and they go back on the back burner. You know, in other words, what you do is you learn not to push a relationship, because if I push the relationship beyond where the other person is comfortable, I emotionally rape that person, and that destroys them. I learn to share slowly. Now, in order that I can do that, I seek multiple relationships. I think one of the greatest tragedies among so many singles is that as soon as they become single and someone of the opposite sex pays them any attention, they latch onto that one point and they put everything they've got into it, and then they literally choke it to death. How do you raise the peak of a pyramid? You broaden its base. I think one of the things that singles need to learn is that as soon as you become single, one of the first things you need to do is get as many friends, and I'm talking about friends, depth relationships, as you can stand, and build more and more. Because the more you build, the better security system you have, emotional security. It's not that we're using people. We're sharing. We're building that support system. For instance, if I'm playing golf, and I've got one golf ball, and I lose that golf ball in the water, I'm out of the game. But if I've got a dozen brand new titles, I can hit that one ball in the water and it hurts. I lose, but I can still play. And I tell people, build that broad base of relationships. See that you develop what I call brother and sister relationships. I can only have one wife. But there's no limit to the number of brothers and sisters that I can have in Jesus Christ. And I try to build that relationship and build as many as possible, because they become my support system. There's another reason that we need to build them as a single. I think one of the tragedies in the family life of our modern society is that we have moved from the expanded family to the nuclear family. Years ago, most families lived within 5 miles of the total family unit. If Bill had a problem understanding his wife, he could talk to his sister or his sister-in-law around the block, the next farm. But nowadays, we're so scattered, we've got husband and wife, 2.5 children, not 4.5 and no more. And when the pressures build, there's no reserve system. There's no way to deal with it. And so, plume, it explodes for the lack of support. Build that broad base and keep that support system. When I was single, I developed many friends. I had a lot of friends who were male, a lot of female friends. These have become my sisters. And they're not a threat to Kathy, because she knows that had I wanted a marriage with one of them, I could have developed that marriage, but they're my sisters. She, on the other hand, had a lot of male friends. I love it. One of them raises Arabian horses. I don't get to ride very often, but if I wanted to, I could always go out to Charlie's. That was her brother. Now it's my brother. I can ride not a nag, but a good quality, award-winning, trophy-winning horse. Hey, He's our friend. He's my brother. He'll come by sometime to visit with us. If I've gone to work already, so what? Kathy tells me what he's got to say. He may have gone down to Mexico or something like this. We saw his wife the other day. They married since then, since we've become brother and sister. She's going to Iowa today. We may stop and visit with her as we're coming back from Canada next week. I don't know, but it's that relationship. Are you with me? Build that broad base, that support system, so that you'll have those friends who can help you at your time of need. Then learn to build upon relationships. I have a very dear friend who, when she went through her divorce, and then a tragic relationship right after that, got to the place that she hated men. She couldn't trust them. She learned to trust men by first trusting me as her grandmother's pastor. Then I moved into another community, and she became a member of our church, and she trusted me as her pastor, then as her friend. After learning to trust me, she took a risk and trusted another man. I'm so glad that shortly after their marriage, we had a lay renewal weekend in our church because her husband was sharing on Sunday night how that he now understood this concept of brother and sister in Christ. I wiped the sweat off my forehead because he's the former professional football player that stands 6'5 and weighs 245. And had he gotten mad at me, he'd just snap my neck like that. But as she learned to trust me, she could learn to trust someone else. And I'm saying learn to trust. As you learn to trust this person and that person and that person, it gives you a support system and you're able to reach out and trust other people. Then if you're going to develop those close relationships, you've got to learn to lay aside competition. If I'm trying to be Mike's best friend, every other friend Mike has is a potential enemy. If Mike began to suspend Pam or Jim, I'm threatened because I'm crossing. Is he spending more time with me than that person? If he's spending more time with him, that must be their best friend, and I get angry. But you see, if I'm trying to be a friend rather than best friend, then I'm glad for him to have those friendships. I'm not in competition with those, and therefore, every friend that Mike has becomes a potential friend of mine, and I can broaden my base that way. I develop a lot more relationships, and it becomes a good support system for me. So I say to people, lay aside competition. Don't try to be the best friend. Simply try to be a friend. Then if you're going to develop some good close relationships, you've got to learn to give freedom. There are two aspects of this freedom that I think are very important. The first is time or space. Men, I know that a bachelor's pad is probably the loneliest place in the world. You've met this beautiful lady, and even her children are neat. And she lives just two blocks off the beaten path between your job and your apartment. And so on the way home from work, you just kind of tool by to see how she's doing. And you get there about the same time she does, and she invites you in, but she goes about doing whatever she's got to do. She goes in, cooks supper, washes dishes, washes the clothes, helps the children with their homework, gives them their bath, finally puts them to bed about 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and then she comes down and sits beside you for the first time all evening. And about 5 minutes later, she looks and says, "Hey, I've got to get up early in the morning. I'm kind of tired. Would you mind going home?" She doesn't love me. Or she says, "Listen, tomorrow, I've got some things to do. Would you mind just doing something?" "Oh, she doesn't love me." And ladies, you met that guy that's a winner. Okay? And you're so afraid of the competition that you have a tendency to just want him around all the time. You're always inviting him over, or you're going to where he is. And one night he says, "Hey, I want to go out with guys tomorrow." "Oh, please don't go out with the guys, because if you go out where the guys are, the girls are always there. And please." And so you just choke them to death, and there's no space, and you wonder what's happening, why they're running. You've got to give some space to them. But there's another part of it, and that is you've got to give them freedom to be themselves. You see that person as a boy. They're just what I want, except this one quality. But I can change that. And in changing it, you may destroy their birthmark. That unique quality that God placed within them that makes them unique and beautiful. Don't try to change the other person. Give them freedom to grow. Oh, yes, you'll share with them and you'll dialogue with them and you'll encourage them. But give them freedom to be themselves. Do not try to control or manipulate, because when you do, you destroy the person completely. Then if you're going to build those friendships and relationships, you've got to learn to convey warmth. Earlier, I asked, what part of your anatomy do you use most in developing trust? I want to ask you now, What part of your anatomy do you use in first establishing contact with another person? Your eyes. Your eyes. I know of a lot of ladies that tell me that one of the resentments they have towards their former mate, death, divorce, is that they're tossed back into the dating game. Especially if they're 34, 35 and up, because years ago when they were in the dating game, it was very simple. The man approached the woman and asked her. Now then, they say, it looks like it's crazy. It looks like a lot of the men want the woman to ask them first, and so many do it. And God, I'm just not that brazen. I just can't push myself out like that. And I just resent it. I sometimes wish I were a man. And the men look at you and say, you know, I sometimes wish you were, because I am scared to death. I've been annihilated by what's happened. My self-esteem has been somewhat put down. And I'm afraid that if I walk up and say, I'd like to talk to you, they say, hey, buzz off, turkey. I don't want to gobble with you. And I find myself just torn up and not wanting to know, Clyde, if that's true, how in the world are we going to ever make contact and begin those relationships? Note what you do with your eyes. The typical single, when they walk into a singles gathering, is looking where? At the floor. Ladies, if you're going to make eye contact looking at the floor, he's going to have to be a mighty low-down fellow. So the first thing you've got to learn to do is get your eyes up to eyeball level. Ladies, if any of you this afternoon have your hand like this, I'll understand. It's perfectly okay. Get your eyes up to eyeball level. That's point number one. Secondly, when you walk in, what do? Every one of you survey the prospects. And after a while, you find that hunk over there and you start staring. After a while, they feel that stare, and then what do? They turn to find from whence cometh the stare. So what do? Invariably, you'll look away and then wonder why somebody who happened to be standing next to you makes contact with the person and you don't, because they accidentally at that moment happen to be looking in the right direction. I tell people, walk in, survey the prospects, notice the one or two that you'd like to talk to, and stare. Then when they finally feel that stare and turn to find from whence it cometh, smile. Now, do not expect them to boogie straight over. They're going to take six laps around the room before they accidentally bump into you. I always tell people that smile says the front porch swing is open. Oh, I wish we could bring back the front porch swing. Remember years ago, you'd have that old two-seater out there on the front porch, and you'd invite a person walking by, hey, come on up and swang a while. And they'd come up and they'd swang with you. And if the relationship developed some potential, invite them to come in and sit with you in the formal parlor. And then if it really began to move along, you'd invite them to have a meal with you in the semi-formal dining room. And then you knew you were really cooking when you had the freedom to come into the kitchen and take a cold biscuit out of the pie safe. Any of you remember those days back in the olden days when ladies got up and made homemade biscuits, not the World War III kind, you know, where pop, 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 it sounds like World War III is beginning. And we had pie safes where we were more practical. Nowadays we have china cabinets where we display this art that's too precious to eat upon. But they had those pie safes, and you'd fix a big old pan of homemade biscuits, and you'd have some left over, and you'd put them in the pie safe to keep the flies off. You come out of the field and you walk in, you take a biscuit and you punch a finger down in there. If you're my kind, you punch two fingers in and then filled it with ribbon cane syrup and bit in. You know, developing it slowly and letting it build relationships. You know what I'm talking about? Today what happens? You meet at the bar and go to the bedroom and wonder why the relationship has no depth. Why it goes sour and falls apart. Because relationships need time to develop. And if you're going to have that development, you've got to learn to convey warmth and then let it build. And another part of that conveying warmth, though, is being positive. Cold is negative. Someone once said that which describes the Texas panhandle from the North Pole is a barbed wire fence, and in some places the barbed wire is down. There are some people I know who act like they're from the North Pole. They're so cold. They're so negative. Everything you ask them is negative. They're down in the mouth and wonder why they don't have any friends. I'm going to tell you, as I said earlier, only sick stinkers want to be around people who are on pity pot. And if you're going to stay on pity pot, you're going to get the stinkers. But if you want to have a positive friend, be positive yourself. Realize God's up to something good and get excited about life. God can change anything. He can work miracles if necessary. So we get excited. It's not going to be like this all the time. There are some exciting things going to happen. Then you've got to learn to affirm people. We all need affirmation. Sometimes ladies will say, Clyde, you talk about this brother and sister relationship, but men just don't want it. All they want is sex. Ladies, there are several things that are real here. First, many of them put the make on you because they're afraid that if they don't, you'll think they're gay. I've actually had ladies say, Clyde, is Charlie okay? I mean, we've had 3 dates and he hasn't put the make on me yet. Or is he a little weird? And that gets back and so they say, well, I've got to prove I'm a man. But there's another part of it. Many men feel that their self-esteem has been annihilated, and one way they feel like they can build it up is through sex. Now, if you just turn and say, man, dirty, what does that do? Annihilate them? Well, I'm just a dirty person, I guess. Dirty old man. But if you can turn to them and say, in a very positive way, hey, I can handle that. That's not a put-down. And then learn to stroke them, to compliment them about themselves, about their masculinity. Most of them, I believe, want that affirmation enough that they will bypass the physical in order that they can get the emotional affirmation. Now, do not be surprised that they try 3 times that first night. They've got to find out if you're playing games. Now, after the 3rd time, they try again that night. You can look and say, listen, I tried to tell you a nice word. That's not where I am. That's not what I want in a relationship, and I have that right. If that's all you're interested in, there's the door, because when I invited you into the living room, I did not give you the key to my bedroom. Now, you just develop that relationship with that person. You've got a good relationship. Periodically, they may try again just to see if you changed your mind. But all I'm saying is, all you have to do is just say, hey, I cannot handle that. That's not where I am. And then learn to compliment them, and they will build a relationship. Men, women want that same affirmation. If you want a relationship with a woman, learn to compliment her, especially on who she is. More than what she does, who she is, and she will buy into it, because we all need to know that somebody believes in us and cares about us, and somebody can compliment us. Learn to be affirming if you want to develop some good relationships. Then, you've got to be willing to reveal yourself. Relationships never develop unless you share who you are and let the other person share who they are. There must be a mutuality in this, because I've got to know who you are to know where you are, and vice versa. I've also got to develop sensitivity. Several times I've had things like this happen. One day, I was sitting in my office and I felt led to call a lady, not a member of our church, a member of another church, very active in their singles ministry, and I knew she was content. But feeling a need, I picked up the phone thinking I'd just call and see how she was doing. Wound up talking to her for over an hour. At the time of the phone call, she was so depressed, her children were gone to be with their father, that she had in one hand the pills to commit suicide, the other hand the water to take the pills with, and had to put them down to answer the phone. She's still alive. Another occasion, one night, I wanted to go visit 2 people. One was a couple that lived 20 miles from the church. The other was a single lady that lived 15. I went to visit with the couple first, could not find their home. Came back to visit with the single lady. She was not at home. Called the daughter of the couple, found out 2 numbers had been inverted. I went back, visited with them, stayed a lot longer than I intended. And a little after 10 o'clock, I left their home, driving back to the house. And as I was driving by where this single lady lived, I felt compelled to visit. I actually drove by, turned around, and came back. I knocked on the door. When she came to the door, she looked at me, and tears began to roll down her cheeks. And she says, Clyde, I know God still loves me. And began to share with me how taking place in another city was an event that if it did not work out just right, she was ready to commit suicide, and she had the medication to do it. She was a nurse. Say, Clyde, how did you do something like this? I did nothing more than every one of you can do. What do you mean? The Bible says God's Spirit bears witness with our spirit, and when we are in tune to the Holy Spirit, we can become sensitive with other people and where they are at that given moment. But there are 2 reasons we often do not. And I just want to use CB lingo and to help you understand. First is, there's a term among CBers. Got your ears on? It means that you have the set turned off. Sometimes there's so much garbage you just don't want to be bothered and you turn the set off. When you do that, what happens? You can't hear. Are you in tune to God? Are you listening to His Holy Spirit? There's a second one. Whenever you talk on a CB radio, you mash a little button on the side of the mic that engages the transmitter, but it also turns off the receiver. You cannot talk and listen at the same time. Did you catch that? And yet I see 2 people, both of them talking. Someone starts saying, yeah, but you ought to feel this way. You're not listening. If you're already giving me advice, if you're already judging me, you're already condemning me, listen to where I am first. But we just, hey, listen, if you want to develop sensitivity, then if you're going to develop these friendships, you've got to develop time to dialogue. Conversation is not automatic. You've got to work at it. I know so many couples that get married, boy, they've got such a closeness one with another. Why? They've been talking. Then they get married and they stop talking. Do you know that the average couple knows more about each other within the day to 6 months after they get married than they do 5 to 10 years after they've been married? Why? People are changing, but we don't listen. We're talking. We don't have time to talk. Well, I did all that when I was dating. Do you still love me? Well, I told you so when I married you. If I ever change my mind, I'll tell you again. I'll tell you then. Well, hey, the only way you continue a relationship is you learn to schedule time to talk one with another, to dialogue. I know of one couple that planned every morning to get up 10 minutes early so they could talk with each other. Where they were, what was going on, not the children, themselves. My wife and I don't always do it. But we found that if we will walk, it's good for us physically, emotionally, and relationally. See, when I'm jogging, I can't talk, but when we walk, we're just out there for 45 minutes to an hour, we can talk about where we are, what's going on, her feelings, my feelings, and we dialogue with one another. I'm saying if you want relationships, plan time to dialogue. Schedule time for conversation. It is a must. Then, if you're going to have good relationships, you've got to learn to accept friendship, but do not demand it. See, a lot of us think that our worth is determined by whom we have as friends. And so if I have this person as my friend, I'm more worthy than if I have this person as my friend. So what we have a tendency to do is, I want your friendship. It's got to have your friendship. Hey, I've learned a startling fact. Some people do not want to be my friends. I mean, I cannot understand why anybody would not want to be my friend, but some people just don't want to be my friend. Now, I could take a .357 Magnum and say, you're going to be my friend. And as long as they're in pistol range, they'd be my friend. But the day they got outside of pistol range, be his friend. He's crazy. He'll kill you. So what I've learned to do is accept but not demand. Now, periodically, what I'll do is go by and knock on their door and see if they've gotten some smarts and now want to be my friend. If they don't, they don't know what they're missing. I accept but do not demand friendship. And then I've got to learn that if I want friendships, I've got to be game-free. That is, I've got to stop play-acting and become real. That's frightening to me because when I'm real, I show my faults, my deficiencies. When I'm always doing what I think you want me to do, I may keep your friendship for a while, but deep within, I feel like I'm losing. Something's not there. It's not quite what I really need and want. Now, as I'm trying to be open, though, and develop friendship, I've learned a couple simple facts. First, avoid being totally game-free. The game of being game-free. We went through a time in psychotherapy where the object was to just get together and dump. So we had our dump sessions. We'd get together, we'd just dump everything we were feeling. But normally, we didn't share what we were feeling about ourselves. You know what we did? We shared what we were feeling about the other person. And we just annihilated them. I think going around doing that and thinking that everybody is going to be totally open with me and I can have a perfect 10 relationship with everybody is as crazy as the story of the man who was given a new wardrobe and nobody had the courage to tell him that he was naked. You see, I believe that we can only have that totally intimate relationship, 9.5 to 10, with 1 or 2 people. Now, what I want to do is, I want to have a lot of 7s and 8s, and some 6s and 5s and 4s. Someone asked me, Clyde, how long does it take to get to a level 10 with a person? I says, it depends upon where they begin. If they begin with a level 1, it takes a lot longer than if they begin with a level 8. What I'm trying to do in my life is to have a couple 9.5 or 10s. My wife is my number one friend who knows me. Then some other people who know me. Then I want to have some up here around level 8. And then I want to have some more up here. And I want to just keep going with that spiraling pyramid, if you will. The other thing is, avoid the game of playing hard to get. Sometimes I'll hear ladies say, Clyde, there's a lady at the office, and she plays hard to get. You know what I'm talking about? You know, when a guy calls her, she's always doing something else, or she's got another date, and they keep calling until they get a date. And they say, Clyde, she plays this game, and she's always got dates. I said, yes, she does. But she doesn't have a mate. You see, whenever you play the game of hard to get, and you're gotten, the game is over. Do you catch that? In other words, when you get the date, or better still, when they score, they've won. The game's over. So they go on to some other relationship, and there's no need to continue that relationship. But when you and I are honest, we can build relationships. It may take a lot longer. Some people may not build that relationship with us, but those that do will become deep friends. As I said earlier, one does not have to be married to be happy. But one must be involved in meaningful relationships to be content. The answer for loneliness is not business. It's friends. You lonely? Create friendships. And I think one of the best things you can do right now is to begin to look around you and see people around you and say, I need friends, so I'm going to make it a priority in my life to build some close, meaningful relationships. For when you have friends, you may be alone at 2 o'clock in the morning in your home, but you're not lonely because you know that if you had to, you could pick up the phone and call Bill or Mary, and if Bill and Mary's out of town, you got Jim or Jane, and you've got friends, and you can find one of those friends that will relate to you. One lady said, Clyde, one day I was very down. I called my first friend. They were out of town. Another friend, they were busy. Another friend I called, they were going to do something else. But they heard the tone of my voice, and I was feeling real down. They called me back and said, hey, I hear something in your voice. Can I meet you for a cup of coffee? When you have that broad base of friends, you may be alone, but you are never lonely. Make a friend.